Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'm Representative Shelley Medora, Chair of the Disabilities Working Group, and this morning we are going to be dealing with public safety issues in people with disabilities. And for those of you who remember from last month, the purpose of this group is to discuss issues. It's not generally going to be legislation specific. And the reason we wanted to focus our agendas in that direction is that it allows us to have conversation outside of advocacy for a bill position. And I think that that's really important. I think that we've been missing that conversation for a very long time here with regards to people with disabilities, and how actually bringing them into the conversation is very, very important for us as legislators. So this morning, I'd like to, since some of you weren't able to meet our two other members this morning, the chance for them to introduce themselves, speak to if they have any particular interest in a disability-related area, or if you're just really glad to be here and serving on the committee. So why don't we start, start down here with Representative Kim Norton.
Kim Norton from, I represent Rochester, which is District 29B. I do have an educational background in the area of special education. I have a Bachelor's of Science in Early Childhood Special Education, and have worked birth to three in a Part H funded program for 3 years in Rochester. So I have personal interest, and I'm also very pleased to be on the committee just in general. Thank you.
I'm Representative Carla Bigham. I am from District 57A, which is South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, and Great Cloud Island Township. And I also serve on the Public Safety Committee. And so this is of special interest for me today. And if you remember the last meeting, I had brought this up as far as being able to have the Public Safety Department interact with the disability community. So. Very pleased to be here.
And Representative
McFarland. Yes, I'm Representative Carol McFarland, representing 53B, White Bear Lake, White Bear Township in North Oaks. I'm serving on the Housing and Public Health Committee here at the House, and also in the Higher Ed Workforce Development. A little bit of my background, I served for 10 years on the 916 Foundation Board, which supports the Northeast Central Intermediate School District and a lot of their special services, and I was also involved in the affordable housing network in my community.
Thank you very much. And of course, our committee administrator is Jennifer McNurtney, and Jen is a very busy woman, and I know that she's been communicating with a lot of you today with regards to the meeting. And I guess at this point now, what I'd like to do is let you know the format for today. You do all have an agenda. We'll be bringing up the testifiers. At this point, because we're starting pretty much on time, I think what we will do is have the testifiers sit, and we'll ask if there are any questions before you leave the table. Then we'll move on throughout the agenda. We do have DPS here, Department of Public Safety, available to answer any questions specific. But again, I hope that they're here today just to listen and to find out what it is that people are talking about and where we may have some gaps that we might look at being able to fill. And I just would very much like for this to be an interactive committee hearing. So with that, I'd like to first call our first testifier this morning is John Wilshire and Margot Cross, and then we'll be discussing emergency preparedness.
Good morning.
Was it situated here?
Yeah.
And if you could just introduce yourself again for the record and where you're coming from.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And we want to thank you for having us come here this morning to speak on this very important issue. I'm just going to give a brief overview, just a few-second version of who the Minnesota State Council on Disability is before I pass it over to the person who really knows what she's talking about over here. That's key in every staff, is to have the one person who knows the majority of the things that are going on in the office, and that would be Margo. But first off, the State Council on Disability, we were created in 1973 as an advisory agency to the governor, state legislature, state agencies, and the public. And we exist to, you know, advise just on disability issues. We have four core issues. They are information referral, technical assistance on regarding laws, regulations, and building code, research, and of course advisory recommendations. So within those four core areas, then we have a variety of issue areas that we actually work within, and they are many. Employment, some healthcare, some education, transportation issues, of course. Disability parking, voting rights, and so forth. ADA laws and regulations. Relocation, in terms of helping people relocate out of nursing homes into the community setting. Some housing issues. Then disability parking, if I didn't mention that. And, of course, the issue we're going to be talking about this morning, and that is emergency preparedness. That is our newest issue to add on top of what we're already doing. So at this point, I'm just going to pass it right on over to Margot. She's our access specialist in our office, and she's been with us for many years, and she is certainly our go-to person in the office.
Thank you. Welcome. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margot Indick Cross, and I'm the accessibility specialist for the Minnesota State Council on Disability. As I begin my testimony this morning, I'd like to draw your attention to the handout. And the first part of the handout is a quick self-survey that I would like everyone in the room to take. We don't have to pull out our pens at this point, but just in your own mind, you can answer the following questions in regard to your own personal preparedness. And that these questions are pretty self-explanatory. But how many of us in this room do have a kit of basic supplies readily available should there be an emergency? Copies of our insurance cards and bank information in airtight containers and readily accessible to us should we need that information? How many of us in this room have talked to our family and friends about our emergency plans or ways to communicate with family during an emergency? How many of us have animals, pets, service animals, and what are our plans for those animals? And how do we plan to get out of each room in case of a fire? How many of us know not or have knowledge of our local emergency plans and procedures? Is the closest shelter to our home accessible to us? Do they have the services that we might need? Do we have an evacuation plan? Or, as many of us will check this box, none of the above. So hopefully, with a little education, we're hoping to have a huge impact in this state. Although Americans enjoy relative security in their everyday lives, the threat of emergencies such as natural disasters, accidents, and acts of terrorism are only too real. Unfortunately, many people and organizations do not adequately plan for such situations, usually because lack of knowledge on how to proceed. Emergency planning is critical for the workplace and the home. According to the results of the national census, approximately 20% of the population has a disability as defined by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Many more individuals have physical, sensory, or cognitive limitations that do not rise to the level of an actual disability. As our society ages, the number of individuals with disabilities and those with age-related limitations will dramatically increase. Research and I always have trouble with this word. Anecdotal evidence indicates that emergency preparedness, response, and recovery efforts often overlook the needs and perspectives of people with disabilities. Consequently, emergency preparedness plans do not include or adequately address or consider the needs of people with disabilities and could hinder emergency planning in the community, at work, or with regard to our organization affiliation. In 2004, MISCOD heard from individuals with disabilities that local communities were not using their knowledge or expertise in developing their emergency preparedness, response, and recovery plans. In 2005, we took the lead in organizing a statewide conference and brought together the disability community with emergency planners and first responders to create a forum for discussion and to share knowledge. We partnered with the Department of Public Safety's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Division of Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, the American Red Cross, and others to organize this comprehensive conference. In 2006, we were selected by the governor to attend the Working Conference on Emergency Management and Individuals with Disabilities and the Elderly, which was held in Washington, D.C. Delegates representing the elderly, representing the Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management, Minnesota Board on Aging, University of Minnesota Institute on Community Integration, and the Minnesota Department of Health attended as well.
We initialized key statewide partnerships to identify and develop critical emergency management issues for people with disabilities in Minnesota. Since that time, MISCOT has been at the forefront of emergency planning and has developed several training sessions for people with disabilities, employers, and first responders. The Minnesota State Council on Disability provides emergency planning assistance on several levels. Plan development and inclusion. State, county, and municipal entities need a disability and senior-related information to use in their emergency plans. MISCOT is providing leadership in building partnerships between emergency managers and the disability community through the establishment of regional disability teams throughout the state. The teams are comprised of representatives from disability groups and individuals from the Center for Independent Living, Area Agency on Aging, Developmental Disabilities Community, State Services for the Blind, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, and Mental Health Community. We will begin meeting in November with regional managers, emergency managers, and county emergency managers to discuss the community. Who are we? The population. Where do we live? Disability. What are our functional limitations and strengths, or strengths and limitations? Equipment. Where is it located? Transportation. Where is it located? Resources. What are they and how can we secure them? This information will then be incorporated into the emergency planning process for each entity. Personal responsibility. Individuals with disabilities will need to be prepared to be on their own for a period of time following a major disaster. We call this the yo-yo period. You're on your own. In order to educate and empower and prepare people with disabilities, we discuss in each of our trainings the helping syndrome, taking responsibility for self and possibly others. If I'm the caregiver in a family, if I'm the mother in a family, I may be responsible for minors. I can't be separated from those individuals, should there be an emergency. Elements of an emergency evacuation outside the home, evacuation equipment, create a plan at home, develop a checklist of things to do and items to purchase, assemble a disaster supply kit for quick evacuation, and get involved in the disaster or in the development of community emergency plans in your local community. For employers, we work with them to identify employees that might need assistance during an emergency. And I am reluctant to say that that just is people with disabilities. There's a lot of people who don't consider themselves disabled who respond in such a way in an emergency that they would need assistance to evacuate a building. Identify elements of an emergency preparedness plan, such as type of emergency, notification process, routes of escape, etc. Develop an emergency evacuation plan, secure necessary emergency evacuation equipment, and train staff to respond and work with employees with disabilities who might need assistance during an emergency. Practice and planning do make a difference. This is a personal testimony from an individual with a disability who survived both the 93 and the 2001 incidents at the World Trade Center. During the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, a man with a mobility impairment was working on the 69th floor. With no plan in place, it took this individual over 6 hours to evacuate the building. After that, he realized he needed to do something. So he worked with his employer to secure emergency evacuation equipment and to train staff in his agency to assist him. In 2001, it took the same individual working on the same 69th floor of the World Trade Center an hour and a half to evacuate. The preparation and planning literally saved his life. First responders, we offer cross-disability awareness training for professionals, including emergency managers and first responders, trainers from the deaf, blind, senior, physically disabled, developmentally disabled, and mental health communities partner with us to provide this training. In order to continue this important work, MISCOT needs to dedicate additional staff time and resources for the ongoing and ever-increasing demand for emergency management technical assistance. We firmly believe that statewide conferences should be held on a regular basis to ensure that people with disabilities are educated on being prepared for emergencies, and emergency managers and first responders are educated on disability issues. No longer can we just be told to wait in a refuge area while a building burns or a bridge collapses. People with disabilities should be treated with the same dignity and respect that all people get when an emergency occurs. And that concludes my testimony. Other questions?
Thank you, Margot. Other questions from the committee? Representative Raymond?
Thank you for your testimony, and it was a pleasure getting to know both of you in my first session dealing on the State Government Finance Committee. You're talking about these trainings starting in November with some of the local governments and emergency preparedness organizations and directors. What format will these trainings take place in? Are they going to be, how are you planning on delivering the training to them?
Right now, we are conducting training for the disability community on an as-needed basis. We get contacted by different groups who say, come to my organization annual meeting and do a presentation. And we have been. We've actually presented to hundreds of individuals with disabilities so far. And employers. We've had a number of employer training sessions as well. What's actually beginning in November is the establishment of the regional teams. I've been working with the Department of Homeland Security regional managers for a while. We've been trying to establish these regional teams, but because this has been a very difficult year for Minnesota, I was literally kicked off the agenda last spring because of the forest fires in northern Minnesota, and then the floods, and then the bridge collapse, and so it's been a very difficult. So I finally got my first session started, organized for southwestern Minnesota. So Region 3, which is the emergency management region in southwestern Minnesota, will be meeting with their county emergency managers on November 7th. And this regional disability team comprised of professionals and people with disabilities from that area, because I think every region has a different characteristic. What's an emergency management issue in southwestern Minnesota is probably not the same for northeastern Minnesota. So we've got a group of people who are meeting with those county emergency managers and the regional emergency managers to help develop their ongoing emergency evacuation plans for the counties and for that region. Because every couple of years they need to be updated. We know for a fact that most of them do not have adequate information in them regarding the disability community or the senior community. We need to flush out the facts. Where are the resources? Where's the population? What's the notification system going to look like? What's the transportation available? How are we going to get that transportation to people who need them? How are we going to communicate with people who are deaf or hard of hearing? Where are the sign language interpreters for that area? So people from deaf and hard of hearing services, state services for the blind, and so on are going to be part of those regional teams.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. My question is similar, and it sounds like the regional meetings or your regional teams may handle this, but I wondered if you, I think the story that you shared was rather compelling with regard to the employers, and that was certainly one example, but I do think it's going to be important to get beyond. I think personal responsibility is huge, but I think we need to get into the businesses and make certain that business leaders think of all their employees and the different situations. So I wondered if you had a plan to work with Chambers of Commerce and some of that through some of these kind of eye-opening, just have this eye-opening discussion with them and then ask them as employers to move forward with your suggested plans of action.
Representative Norton, that's exactly what we are planning to do. Because of our limited resources and very small staff of our agency, we've had to take this in chunks. And so right now we are putting a plan together for employers. Chambers of Commerce are exactly the types of groups that we will be contacting and addressing. Thank you.
I actually have two questions. The first one being, you know, recently there, or you may not be aware, there was a lawsuit in Louisiana for a dog that somebody had taken from somebody who had to be evacuated. And it may, as you were talking about here, plan for pets, and in particular service pets. They're not really pets, they're service dogs.
And, of course, now we have some monkeys that are being trained and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Are there identifiers on these pets so that should they become separated from their owner, that they're able to be identified as service animals to, or as they're, has that not even been discussed yet?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. I know that if the animal has been trained by a recognized school, that they typically do have a harness of some nature. I don't know if they have those little chips in them. That's something I can find out and get back to you. I do know that there's a growing population of people who need companion animals.
Mm-hmm.
And companion animals aren't required to have any kind of identification at all. So that might be where we need to really look at.
Well, this discussion that I had read the news on, I was just shocked that it could escalate to this, and the thousands of dollars that are poured into training these animals for service to their owners, I would just think that we would have to replace that. But then on top of it, those dogs are usually very well trained to bond very quickly with new owners, and you're putting both the animal and the new owner in a precarious situation, so that identifier would immediately be able to put them back where they need to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing, have you issued some sort of a statement from the office? One thing, as I talk to many parents, is that they're not aware that they should let their 911 dispatch centers know that there's a member in the household with a disability. And has there been a statewide alert mailed out saying you should contact the 911 dispatcher? In our autism community in particular, that's an issue because a child will generally run and hide. And then that could be viewed as criminal behavior and escalate to another level, which hopefully we'll be talking about today. But has there been an alert mailed out, or has DPS issued a statement saying, you know, we should know that if there's a disabled person in the household and how the police should react to that person?
Madam Chair, when we do our training to the disability community, that is one of the messages we give them, is to contact their local fire department and police department. Make sure that people know, but then be sure to contact them should you move or should you not be home for an extended period of time, so that if something happens in your absence. But no, I know we haven't done a statewide alert.
No.
Shall we ask Barb Ponson? She's awfully quiet back there.
Yes, Barbara, she is available here. Yeah. It's my,
Madam Chair, I don't know of any broad statements on public safety that have been put out. There is an issue that always comes up of the identification of a person with a disability in their own home, as how that information is used, by 911, by emergency responders, and with assurances that this is not an emergency and it's primarily for correct assistance, to be given at the time of an emergency.
Do you want to come?
Purely voluntary for a person to be notified.
Barb, would you like to come to the panel? We have a few more questions, so it might be helpful that way too. You're being recorded. And Barb, if you can just identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Barb.
My name is Barb Fonkert. I'm a planner for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Public Safety.
Well, so if you can just, I don't know if the tape was able to catch your last part.
Sure.
So there has not been a statewide alert, and then assurances that, is there a form of some sort that assures the individual that the information is just going to the police department for dispatch response or that sort of thing? Or
Madam Chair, that would be the responsibility of the local police department or dispatch center. There are some areas in the state that have chosen to do this, some areas that have gone so far as to try to put together a volunteer registry of people who have any number of different kinds of disabilities. Again, it has to be purely voluntary. But we have gotten some good response in a couple of areas of the state.
And Representative Bruce Anderson has just arrived, and if we could just take a moment before you ask your question. Thank you for coming this morning, and I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself to the audience and any area in particular that you have related to disabilities that you'd like to share. And your key committee that you're here is our housing committee.
Mm-hmm.
So
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Bruce Anderson. I have been a state representative from Wright County for, oh, this is my 13th year. And I have a daughter who has cerebral palsy and have been interested in the area of special needs disabilities, because I had a baby brother that was mentally retarded also. So it's been those things that have been in my family that have spurred me on to be a part of this. And so I look forward to what we're going to hear in testimony and what is going to happen with our committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
One question that I would have is if a disabled person calls their dispatcher and tells them about the disability, that when an emergency service person would come, do they get told what kind of disability it is, like whether it's vision or hearing or any other?
No, the information the dispatcher gets would be given to the responding agency, whichever responding agency it would be. They do have some procedures for dealing with various types of disabilities. It's one of the things that they probably, you know, continually train on, but I'm not familiar with the exact types of training and that they are given. So just the knowledge of having that information would at least help them in their response.
Right, but I mean, so they don't know exactly what they're walking into other than the fact that there is a disabled person in the house. They don't know if it's a hearing impaired or a vision impaired person.
If that was said to the dispatcher, that will be passed on, definitely.
Barbara, did you have a response?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bingham. And even though people are, you know, informed that if they want to, they should contact their local precincts and keep it as local as possible and indicate that they have a disability, we try to make sure people aren't lulled into a false sense of security. Because should there be a disaster of some nature, the likelihood of individuals with disabilities being at the top of the list for being, you know, evacuated from their homes. And yeah, we can't guarantee that. So people are still encouraged to prepare and be prepared to be on their own for a period of time and to have a backup system in place.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Norton?
I think I do. Thank you very much. As a backup to this, it was stated earlier that this is voluntary, that families, that there's not a requirement that you notify the 911 or your local emergency. And I guess if they're thinking about this, and I know the privacy issue, at least in healthcare, one of the communities I serve on, is huge, and so I think probably that having it voluntary will make people happier. Is there a different level of responsibility? You mentioned just because they may know that a X amount of disabled people live in this community and there's an emergency, is there a different level of expectation or legal requirement to service people who have identified themselves by your local law enforcement as opposed to perhaps them not knowing?
Madam Chair,
question.
Representative Norton. Not that I know of. I don't think there's a legal requirement. I think it's part of an emergency plan. I know that there are individuals who would be very reluctant and resistant to identifying themselves, and I know that many, many people are opposed to what we call a register, and because of privacy issues and so forth. But I don't believe that there's an added legal requirement. I've not heard of any. I just know that it's part of the plan. You make that part of your emergency plan for that particular government entity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's what I figured the response was. I guess I just wondered, as we move forward with this, as we think about it, if someone has called their local authority and identified themselves, and I just was wondering if, you know, in the long run, is that going to have any impact on the length of time that someone might take to go there in an emergency? If you put your name on the list, do you rise above anyone else? And would there be any legal recourse later if you weren't responded to? So I know there isn't an answer to that. It was just a question I had, so I appreciate you responding. Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right, well, thank you very much. This has been very interesting, so I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you.
If I may conclude, I've got a few brochures on the current brochures on emergency preparedness, and we're in the process of developing new emergency preparedness brochures to be handing out and a toolkit to be used. And then, of course, our trusty whistles. Everyone needs a whistle, whether one is hearing capable or not. Hopefully somebody would be able to hear one if you were to need it. So I'd like to give those so you can at least feel you're prepared while working here for the state.
We need a whistle that lights up. That helps our other community members here. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next on the agenda, we have Mary Hartnett from the Commission on the Deaf and Hard of Hearing. Deaf and hard of hearing people, and she has some testifiers that will be joining her. And Mary, if you could please introduce those folks to me when they're ready.
Thank you.
And introduce yourself, please, too.
Yes, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm with the Minnesota Commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. And thank you for holding this hearing to shed light.
My name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. And I want to thank you for holding this hearing to shed light on this important issue. Audism, A-U-D-I-S-M, is discrimination based on someone's inability to hear, and it's pervasive in our culture. We have today with us one story that is a clear example of this, and it's Doug Ball's story, who's sitting next to me. Doug Ball is a college professor, a husband, a father, and former president of the Minnesota Association of Deaf Citizens, and he held that position for 10 years. He was held in such high esteem by the community. It's the state's largest consumer organization for deaf people. And we also have today with us Emily Peplin, a recent graduate of Yale Law School and an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the Disability Law Center. She just started her position September 1st. Ms. Peplin says that her dream job is defending the rights of deaf people, and she got that job. And Joseph Walla, who is a Truman Fellow and a candidate for a Rhodes Scholarship, who postponed his interview with the provost at the University of Minnesota to sit and observe Mr. Ball's trial, which happened last week, because he's so committed to human rights and is the son of a deaf and has a parent who is deaf. So all of these folks are tireless advocates for the rights of deaf and hard of hearing students, and we'd like you to hear their story.
Thank you.
And you see pictures of Mr. Ball and what occurred to him. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Doug Ball, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify. On November 17th of 2006, I was driving on the road. I was going to visit my wife in the hospital. I did go through a red light, and the police pulled me over, and I pulled over to the side of the road. And I knew what I was generally supposed to do. I was supposed to keep quiet. I was not supposed to reach for my wallet at all. I wasn't going to touch anything in my car because the police might think I might be looking for and grabbing for a gun. So I grabbed onto the steering wheel and waited for the officer to approach my car. I pulled down my window, and the officer was standing there and was speaking to me. And I was looking at him, and I didn't understand what he was saying. It was very difficult. He thought maybe I could try to listen, but I couldn't repeat it at all. I was gesturing to him and even pointing to my ear, saying that I could not hear. And I was drawing like that piece of paper and to write, and he continued to speak to me. And I was looking at him, and I repeated, pointing to my ear that I couldn't hear, and was drawing out a piece of paper that I wanted to write. And this continued. He ignored my request, or maybe didn't understand the request, maybe thought I was hearing, and he tried to gesture me and grabbed my wrist, very, very strongly grabbed my wrist, and I tried to let him know that I was in pain, and I was under doctor's care at that time. I was taking medication for a severe joint pain that I was experiencing. And I wanted him to understand what I was saying, and I wanted him to understand that he was indeed hurting me. And really that even just touching my wrist was severe pain for me. And I do have a card. I have a UPS, United Postal Service card, that was right here in my bag, and I tried to turn that over. And just to let him know that I was in pain, I wrote down the word joint, J-O-I-N-T, on that piece of paper. But I did not complete the word. The officer then pulled out some mace and maced me, and by that time it was over. I really was in shock and what had happened. And I am a deaf person, and with the mace that was sprayed in my eyes, I was then completely blind. My eyes were burning. They were swollen. I was in panic mode at that point. So the officer grabbed me, pulled me out of the car, and I could not see anything that was going on. And really, I was terrified at that point. My arms were hurting, my body all over, and really, I was in pain. And worse, obviously, was my eyes were being maced and being pulled out of my car. The window of the officer car was pushed up against the window of his car, and I was trying to tell them I was in pain, and again, he maced me again, and oh boy, I was pulled down onto the ground, forcibly. I was bleeding from my face and my shoulder, and I tried to open my eyes, and I couldn't see. It was very difficult. I could see just a little bit. I could see lights that were flashing around me, but I really could not see anything. I was just completely terrified. And really very confused at the same time. I was badly injured, and I was arrested and brought to the hospital, to the emergency room. And later on, they did bring me to the Ramsey County Jail. And I did request an interpreter. They refused to provide me with an interpreter. And I also requested a TTY while I was in jail. And I continued to request for a TTY. And a TTY really means it's a telephone device for deaf people to use to make a phone call, or you could use a computer to have that is accessible services that are online. But they continue to deny my request. From Friday until Monday, I was in jail, and I had no interpreter during that entire time. I had no access to a telephone, and no way to let my family or my lawyer or my family know what was happening. And at that time, my wife, her name is Sue, she was in the hospital at that time, and she was recovering from surgery. And actually, an inmate who was there with me, he felt sorry. He approached me and was writing a note and asking me if there was anything he could do, if he could make a phone call for me. And I said, oh, if you don't mind, if you could call my wife who was in the hospital and explain to her. She was at Fairview Hospital at that time in Minneapolis. And he was happy to go ahead and make that phone call for me. He called his wife, and his wife called over to the hospital to let her know where I was, that I was in jail. But my wife, they did try calling, and they called back to the inmate, and the inmate let me know. I said, the phone just kept on ringing in her room. And I'm like, well, my wife is deaf as well. So they're like, oh, the inmate realized that and called back to his wife. And his wife then called back to the hospital and talked with the nurse's station and asked her to please write a note for my wife, Sue, so that she can know that I'm in jail. The nurse did do that, walked into her room and handed her that note to my wife, who then read the note and started to smile, actually, and was very thankful for her. And the nurse was like, was just perplexed, just puzzled, like, you're showing a smile from this note that said your husband is in jail. And she said, yes. She really thought that I had died. I was gone for 3 days and heard nothing from me. Nobody had heard from me for 3 days. And now she was relieved to know that I was still alive. So she felt okay. She felt good, and that's why she had the smile. But later on, my family did learn, and they as well was worried about me because I was missing for 3 days. And actually, my wife had called the police department wanting to file me as a missing person. But the police said no, they couldn't file that until Monday. So once she did find out, that's how she found out, was through an inmate in jail. Mm-hmm. And then that word spread to my family where I was. My brother did come down to the police station to bail me out of jail. And the next day, I went to in front of a judge, but there was no interpreter there. It was decided then to postpone the hearing. The problem with jail, they did not inform the court that I was a deaf individual and required an interpreter. And that's a true story that happened to me. I have never been arrested in my life prior to this. And I really, before this, had trusted police department. I trusted the system, and now I don't. I live in fear and with no trust. And I don't want this to happen to a deaf person, and that's why I'm here today. I just encourage you to change the system and to make it more fair so that no other person has to experience the same thing as I did. So thank you again for listening to my story.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Davis?
All of this over a red light, huh?
Yes.
We appreciate your bravery of coming here and telling us your story, and we too hope that this will never happen to somebody else. So, what was the reason why they wouldn't do accommodate you for needs, whether it was to let you write a note, to make a phone call, you know, with the adapter, and what was the reason that they kept giving you when you would request these accommodations?
I'm going to give this over to Emily.
Can you identify yourself too, please? I will. Hi, my name is Emily Teplin. I work with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm an Equal Justice Works Fellow. Representative Brigham, to respond to your question, Mr. Ball does have a pending civil suit, and we'd just like to refrain from addressing the specifics of what happened to him in jail. Thank you, though.
Can I ask then what I guess I'd like to ask, and perhaps if there's somebody from DPS, what is the standard protocol when, I mean, is, for example, this is choking. If you were to do this in a restaurant or in front of a police officer, they would know this means you're choking. Is there some sort of indicator that the deaf community has to identify themselves to a police officer or to somebody else in the community to say, I'm deaf? I mean, he said he was pointing to his ear. I do that now when I can't hear something. I point to my ear and people respond with speaking up a little bit more. Is there some sort of signal that's taught to the community to use to identify themselves?
One huge problem in this state is that there's no uniform training for police officers in terms of how to interact with people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I think Mr. Ball, in his many years of communicating with hearing people on a daily basis, would be in a good position to answer this question in terms of how he lets hearing people know that he's deaf and needs to communicate through writing. Okay. Doug?
Yes. Madam Chair, oftentimes I communicate with hearing people and I just use that gesture of writing or pointing to my ear. I use that quite often and I don't have a problem. Sometimes they still don't understand, but I just repeat things. So I pull out a piece of paper and it goes along just fine, and that's how I do it every day.
Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you, and I would agree that's a fairly uniform visual, you know, picture for folks to help, and I'm kind of surprised. But I also wondered if you had made vocalizations, understanding that vocalizations are often unique and identifiable with someone with a hearing impairment or deaf or hard of hearing. Did you use vocalizations with the police officer when you were stopped? And what was his response?
No, I did not. No, I did not use my voice. But later on, used my voice to scream in pain. Then, of course, I expressed my feelings using my voice at that point.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ball, thank you for coming this morning and happening in our state for those people who are in need of some understanding of the situation. The question I have for you, does your driver's license have anything on it to indicate that you are deaf or hard of hearing?
No, but there is a special restriction that's on the license. It's kind of, it's at the mirror, if you've heard of that, on the driver's license. Do you want me to show you what it looks like? I do have my license with me. But it does show that it is a deaf person, but it's not labeled as deaf. It just has a special restriction on the driver's license, but does not use the word deaf on it.
Sure. I've been wondering if DPS would know if they are trained on what are supposed to have significant indicators on the driver's license as to what type of a person has, whether he is a donator of his organs or so forth and so on. If that is on the driver's license, are the officers not trained to be aware of something like that?
Bob, would you like to address that? Sorry to put you on the spot with this one. We should probably have Betsy Parker here from MnDOT. Yes, sir. You can identify yourself, please.
Yes, I'm Joseph Bowler with the Department of Public Safety, Drive and Vehicle Services Division, and there is no indicator on the driver's license that would say somebody is deaf or that somebody is disabled anyway. We do not keep that type of information on driver's license files.
Madam Chair, that would be something that we as the legislature should probably look into for this session.
If I may, Representative, I'd just like to add that in Mr. Ball's case, the miscommunication occurred before he had the opportunity to show his driver's license.
Yeah.
So Mr. Ball attempted multiple times to express his desire to communicate through writing with the officer, which is how Mr. Ball, in his many years of communicating with hearing people on a daily basis, often asked to communicate with hearing people.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, the situation with people who are in a situation with a disability, they also have a blue card usually hanging in there on the rearview mirror that says they're disabled community. I know I have one for my daughter when I carry her around every time I go someplace so I can park there. I'm wondering if someone like Mr. Ball or others who are in that situation that are disabled, if they could have something on that blue card, especially since it's his, for him or his wife, or the situation, his family, that would indicate to a law enforcement officer that there is a special person in this car, whether it's him or daughter, like for me, or another person, that could indicate, even on this blue card, that maybe that's something we as the legislature have to look at for future, but it sure should be something that law enforcement should be concerned with and aware of for future.
At the end of our testimony, a list of specific recommendations that we'd like to make that could help perhaps that are related to training, data tracking, and certainly looking at the data banks and having specific fields that identify for deaf, hard of hearing, and for the Department of Public Safety. And we also wanted to squeeze in the Department of Corrections here too, are part of the recommendations that we have here. And we'll distribute those at the end of our testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Hartnett or Mr. Ball, do you have a blue card that you hang in your rearview mirror to indicate that you are special needs or special person?
I'm not sure, Mr. Senator, just perhaps Margaret and Bethel from the Sea Council on Disability could explain how the current works with people with physical disabilities, that it's a parking sticker that or an indicator that says that a person with a physical disability and needs to be closer to the building that they're getting into, and persons with some kind of disabilities have no need of that unless they have a dual disability, and so they don't have access to that card and don't need that card, they're physically able to get into the building. So
Representative Bingham?
This question may be for, thank you, Madam Chair. This question may be for the Department of Public Safety or DMV, but I have a restriction on my license because when I was 16, I was like 4'9". I've grown. and so I had to have an elevated seat restriction. And there may have been a possible time where I may have been speeding and maybe an officer
public record
had to talk to me about that. But they knew that when they allegedly but when they pulled me over, they already knew about that restriction because they read my license plate, which then was linked to my driver's license, which then when they typically tap on the computer, they can figure out what restrictions you have to make sure that you are complying with those requirements. I maybe this is going to be the he's in a civil suit thing, but I'm wondering why that wouldn't have at least come up prior to pulling someone over.
Representative Bigham, in Mr. Bell's criminal trial, the officer who pulled him over did testify that he thought Mr. Bell might have been deaf. So, at least in Mr. Bell's case, it seems that the fact that he was deaf was pretty much probably known by the officer. That's why we believe that a problem in this case is actually one of police training on how to interact with deaf people, rather than Mr. Bell not communicating that he was deaf to the officer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ball, as a member of the Public Safety Committee, we will have a discussion about this because I think there are some simple things that we are able to do, whether it is expanding requirements to be able to have a blue card or to make out of front. I know when you're allergic to something, and my mother's allergic to penicillin, and on her driver's license is a big M on there that says that. Whether there's something that we can do that way to help with that training of our police and emergency service folks, along with a lot of other things. But I can promise that we will take, at least I intend to bring this up at the Public Safety Committee.
Before I let you go, I just want to let you know, I can't imagine how terrifying it must have been to have your eyesight compromised. Mm-hmm. You can't hear. I don't think anybody in this room can understand what that must be like, to have no ability to hear and then have your one tool that you use to communicate with compromised. That must have been incredibly, incredibly frightening for you, and I'm sorry that that happened. And I'm frustrated that it happened for you, so I do believe we will be addressing this, and committee members here have heard a very compelling testimony today to discuss this. Representative McFarland,
Madam Chair, Mr. Bell, I'm just wondering who was the arresting officer, and what government unit were they from, the sheriff's office or the city or whatever? Just curious.
It was the city of St. Paul. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. You just have a few additional comments. Myself and Joseph Wallace. Before you get Representative Anderson, just had a
Madam Chair, Mr. Ball, other testifiers, it's really my understanding from, and I've never been in jail, so I can't tell you, I can't experience it, it's been monitored. That was only allegedly, right? Okay. to ask for the ability to make one phone call to at least talk to someone from your family or your lawyer or something like that, and then not provide the wherewithal, I would think that with some pretty poor training going on in St. Paul, in this state, if we can even allow, if what you just said, Ms. Templin, that there was assumed that he was deaf, that some kind of vehicle or some means of being able to allow him to make a phone call, it should have been given that. That would have been a courtesy, just one, to them. What happened? What fell through the cracks here? I mean, is it really that bad, poor police training? If that's the case, is, I don't think we should hire any more police officers until we get trained better.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your question, Representative Anderson. I believe that what happened to Mr. Ball is unfortunately not an uncommon occurrence. It might not have, you know, it may not be the case that deaf individuals often end up with the injuries that Mr. Ball sustained, but our office receives calls and inquiries from people who've had similar experiences to Mr. Ball with some frequency. I do think that there is a statewide problem in training police officers with how to interact with deaf and hard of hearing people, and that does extend to the Department of Corrections as well. It's a huge, urgent, statewide problem that exists in Minnesota, and I agree with you that it requires serious and urgent correction.
Thank you very much, Representative. Yes, you can conclude now if you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wanted to talk about why what happened to Mr. Ball occurred. I believe that what happened to Mr. Ball, while a horrible tragedy, was completely preventable. The officer in Mr. Ball's case insisted on communicating through gesturing and through talking, even though he suspected and believed that Mr. Ball was probably deaf. Mr. Ball wanted to communicate through writing and repeatedly asked to communicate through writing, but the officer continued to deny his many requests. I think that the officer's behavior reflects a very common, very mistaken belief that deaf people can communicate through lip reading. This is a very common and wrong idea. At the most, anyone could understand no more than 35% of what someone says just through reading their lips. And again, I believe that the problem is in the failure to train police officers on how to interact with deaf and hard of hearing people. The common view of this case in the deaf community is that what happened to Mr. Ball is not surprising or unusual. I've been on my job for a few weeks and already have more people with stories like Mr. Ball than we have the resources to take. My fellowship position is to work on communication access issues for deaf and hard of hearing people in the criminal justice system. And after just a few weeks, there are too many clients. Mm-hmm. Our office is already overwhelmed. These training failures are a serious hazard, public safety hazard. Not only are deaf people at risk of suffering a fate similar to Mr. Ball, we're all at risk when deaf and hard of hearing people don't trust the police and don't feel comfortable reporting crime that they see. Another problem is that we don't know how common Mr. Ball's case is. I receive many calls and many inquiries, but those are only from individuals who feel confident enough to come forward, people who know that resources are available. There may be a great many people who don't know how to ask for help. That's the bad news. Here's the good news. We have a few policy recommendations. The first is to require that sheriff's departments, police departments, county jails, track the disability of people who enter their systems so we can know how widespread this problem is. They record race, they record gender, they don't record disability. The second policy recommendation is to make sure that, work with the Post Board to make sure that police trainings on how to interact with deaf and hard of hearing people are mandatory in the state for all Minnesota peace officers. We also recommend that we create a public safety and corrections ombudsman on disability, a position that would handle complaints, you know, relating to communication access, an ombudsman or an ADA coordinator in each agency who could respond to citizen complaints on this issue. The fourth recommendation is that police departments be required to have systems in place for finding interpreters for deaf individuals on an emergency basis. much like hospitals, police departments know that they might have a need for emergency interpreters. They set systems in place to make sure that they can find them when they're needed. Mr. Ball's case has received national attention, particularly among deaf people and their allies. People are watching this case, and what they believe they've seen so far is that in Minnesota, a deaf crime victim has been labeled a convicted criminal. This is the perfect opportunity to turn the situation around. It's the right time to work on this issue. In this next session, I hope you take this problem seriously and work to make Minnesota a model state for relations between deaf people and the criminal justice system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much this morning for coming in. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you again very soon.
Thank you. I look forward to it. Just a few final words from Joseph Wallace.
If you can make it quick, please. Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I wanted to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm what you call a coda in the deaf community, a child of a deaf adult. My father was born deaf. He went to New York University, became a teacher for the rest of his life. My mom has been an interpreter for 37 years. So we grow up in codas in a culturally deaf environment. We use sign language as our first language and the language to communicate with our parents. And we have a feel for the deaf community that few other hearing people might have.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can tell you is after Doug's trial is that I've never felt so much fear and frustration in the deaf community. I mean, I'm only 22 years old, so I mean, that's not a long time, but I've never felt this before. And fear comes from this uncertainty when you don't know the appropriate way to act with someone in a position of authority, someone who actually has the power in this case to harm you. And I've known Doug Ball for years. The deaf community is very close and tight-knit. And I can tell you that he's the kindest, low-key, peace-loving guy I know. And he's not even really, he's not a big person. He's not capable of force. And even after he was injured from the police, he had a calming influence in the deaf community and his family. And he devotes time to others. And he's also led seminars for police officers on how to communicate with deaf people. And so when I heard about this case and when other members of the deaf community heard about this, We've all kind of felt the fear that permeates from this case. If this happened to Doug, couldn't this happen to my father? If this happened to a model citizen of the community, somebody who actually trained police officers on how to communicate with deaf people, who else can it happen to? And so if a police officer refuses to use a pen and paper, what can my dad do to cooperate? If my dad doesn't respond to oral commands, like any other deaf person wouldn't, will he be maced repeatedly, leaving him temporarily blind as well as deaf, then severely beaten up, instead of just receiving a moving violation or a ticket? Then will my dad disappear for 4 days without any contact with the outside world, unable to tell our family where he is, because Joe refuses to provide an interpreter, a system in which to contact those in the outside world, like my family? So for me, this is a strange position to be in, and a strange position for other people in the community. In this early father-son reversal, I'm anxious when my dad goes out, because the only members of our society that are authorized to use force do not know or refuse to utilize the simplest way to communicate with deaf people. And this should create the fear that permeates the deaf community, that is also prevalent among people who are related to deaf people, as our parents or our children or our friends. And so there was this key moment in the trial that I thought was very representative of what it means to be deaf, and I wanted to share it with you right now. The defense lawyer asked Doug, how do you know that when the interpreters sign, when you sign, the interpreters translate accurately? And it was an interesting question, and Doug thought about it for a second, and he said, I guess I just have to trust them, because he has no ways in confirming it. And so as a hearing community, we've severely damaged this trust that we have with the deaf community. And the only way that I can envision fixing it is to support clear guidelines for the interaction between deaf and the police, especially in instances involving the use of force. And clear repercussions, I would only hope, for police officers that do not follow those guidelines. So clear guidelines and fixed consequences for those abiding by them will take away the uncertainty that I talked about earlier. And it's the only way that I can envision the deaf community feeling safe again, for Doug Ball to feel secure again. And it's the only way I can envision people outside of the deaf community, but also part of the deaf community, to feel safe as well when my dad goes out or our family goes out. And those are the words I just wanted to share with you today, and I appreciate you giving the time to listen to me. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Dr. Nancy Fitzsimmons, who may be able to shed some light on this issue for us. She's going to be discussing victims' issues in the criminal justice system. So,
My name is Nancy Fitzsimmons. I'm an associate professor of social work at Minnesota State University, Mankato.
Welcome.
And I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I'm going to focus on the issue of victimization of people with disabilities. I think what I'll do is, you all have sort of my statement, is highlight some of the aspects of this. As you know, and as people in this audience know, people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the United States. So we're talking about a significant number of people. And I'm going to look at, try to explain a little bit about the issue, and then talk a little bit about some of the responsiveness of our systems, and particularly the lack of responsiveness of our systems. Again, and this will include the disability service, the victim service, and the criminal justice system. In terms of understanding the magnitude of the problem, research consistently shows that people with disabilities are victimized at much higher rates than people without disabilities. And in my statement, I've summarized a number of studies, and this is just a small list of what some of those studies are. One of the problems that we do have is, though, is that we do not have any national representative data. There are two ways in which we collect crime statistics in the United States. One of those is from the Uniform Crime Reporting Program that the Federal Bureau of Investigation uses, and that these are reports made by law enforcement to the FBI of crimes that have actually been committed. In this reporting system, disability is not identified. The other way in which we collect data is through the National Crime Victimization Survey. And this survey is a representative sample of nearly 76,000 people in the United States. Again, disability status is not asked in the survey, so again, we don't have national representative data. To address this discrepancy, in 1998, Congress passed the Crime Victims with Disabilities Awareness Act. And unfortunately, due to funding deficits, not a Minnesota state issue, but a federal issue, we are still awaiting data that looks at crime victimization of people with disabilities. Despite these limitations, the numbers of studies that we do have clearly demonstrate that the problem is significant and serious if you look at the body of research. In terms of the research on perpetrators, most crimes, and violent crimes in particular, are suffered at the hands of someone that we know. So the random acts of violence by a stranger is less common than being a victim of a violent crime by somebody that you know. And this is no different for people with disabilities. The most common perpetrators of violence abuse are known to the person with a disability, most notably spouses, partners, family members, and paid caregivers. One of the most unique aspects of vulnerability for people with disabilities is that they are more likely to be victimized by somebody associated with their disability. So we're looking at paid caregivers or others who are connected to them because of their disability. People with intellectual disabilities are also vulnerable to peer on peer abuse, particularly in institutional or other congregate kinds of settings. In addition, we know that perpetrators are far more likely to be males than they are to be females. In terms of the setting, the most likely place in which victimization occurs would be in the person's place of their own residence, where people reside. Our homes should be the safest place, but people with disabilities, they are often not the safest place. In addition, victimization takes place in environments that people encounter as a result of having a disability, including healthcare settings, rehabilitation settings, education settings, vocational programs. And in addition, another area in which people are particularly vulnerable is in the use of transportation services.
whether they be public transportation or whether they be private forms of transportation. It's another area of vulnerability. In the 1970s, there were a number of exposés that focused on institutional abuse. And we certainly changed the way that we provide services for people with disabilities, and the UNICEF no longer has these large-scale institutions. However, one of the things to be mindful of is that the setting, it's not a matter of the place and size. It really has to do much more with the way in which services are delivered. The degree to which service recipients are isolated and have fewer opportunities to mix with people outside of their establishment contributes to the vulnerability and higher rates of victimization. So segregation and isolation are certainly significant issues. In terms of the vulnerability aspect, and I want to be really thoughtful about using this term vulnerable when we talk about people with disabilities. Vulnerable adult refers to a person who's been mistreated or is in danger of mistreatment due to age or disability and is unable to protect him or herself. It is important to remember that not all people with disabilities fall into the category of being vulnerable. It is important to avoid paternalistic policies and practices that unduly take away the rights, self-determination, and dignity of people with disabilities. So I want to put that out as a qualifier as I move forward, that I'm using disability very globally, but we also need to understand that there's a wide range of vulnerability, ability, and issues. Having said that, there are many reasons why people with disabilities are vulnerable to violence and abuse, with majority stemming from the lack of power that this minority group has been afforded in our society and the extent to which their lives are controlled by others. Women with disabilities are doubly vulnerable both due to their status of both having a disability and being women. Women who are racial or ethnic minorities are triply vulnerable. Again, having a disability, having the status of being women, and being racial or ethnic minorities in our society. The reasons for vulnerability vary. Those that are most typically cited in the literature include dependence upon others through long-term care, lack of economic independence, stereotypes and negative attitudes that devalue and marginalize people with disabilities, less risk of discovery as perceived by the perpetrator, difficulty being believed when disclosure is made, social isolation, overprotection, communication, and physical barriers outside of the individual, and as we heard Mr. Ball's story, the barrier was not his, the barrier was the law enforcement officer's response. I want to move to, so that sort of sets the stage of really understanding the vulnerability and the issues. In terms of deficits in the system, there are significant deficits to a system that should be supporting, advocating for, assisting, and providing justice to victims with disabilities. People who work in the disability services system have limited knowledge about violence and abuse issues, and people who work in victim service and the criminal justice system have limited knowledge about disability issues. One of the main limitations of the disability service system that increases the vulnerability to abuse is an environment characterized by overprotection. People with disabilities are not provided with the knowledge, skills, and resources necessary to prevent and protect themselves from relationships and situations that do not promote their well-being. This includes information about sexuality and healthy intimate relationships, assertiveness training, placemaking, and personal rights education. And this is particularly a problem for people with intellectual disabilities. Another issue is disbelief and disclosures of victimization are made is particularly problematic for people with intellectual disabilities, but certainly other disabilities. This disbelief stems from an unwillingness to believe that the alleged perpetrator would engage in abusive behavior. After all, are not all family members, caregivers, and other support people well-intentioned, kind, and caring? And the answer to that question is no. The memory and credibility of people with disabilities are often called into question. For people with intellectual disabilities, the challenge is often being able to tell what happened in sufficient detail and in chronological order. However, this difficulty in remembering the details should not be interpreted to imply that the person is incapable of remembering the core event, that they were victimized, and who perpetrated the victimization. When reports of violence and abuse are ignored or not taken seriously, victims are at greater risk for re-victimization by the same perpetrator or others, and in addition, other vulnerable individuals are at risk. There are limitations in our domestic violence and victim assistance services.
they are often ill-equipped to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities. Domestic violence services are often located in physically inaccessible settings, lack material in alternative formats, lack staff proficient in American Sign Language, and lack staff competent to interact effectively with people with multiple cognitive, receptive, and expressive levels. Domestic violence shelters are often unable to meet the personal care needs of women with disabilities, children of victims, children with disabilities of victims, marriage victims with disabilities, and a lack of appropriate service to address violence and abuse of people with intellectual disabilities. Victims who are deaf or just blind oftentimes have the added burden of teaching service providers about communication and deaf culture. Using a third person as an interpreter decreases privacy and confidentiality. Shelter staff may resort to using children of deaf victims as interpreters, which hinders the role and authority of parents. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of problems within the domestic violence service system. Limited knowledge also extends to law enforcement and other components of the criminal justice system that often poorly serve people with disabilities. Law enforcement personnel have little training in needs of people with disabilities, resulting in a lack of responsiveness to victims with disabilities. The communication needs of people with disabilities are not always accommodated, particularly people who are deaf, speech impaired, or have intellectual disabilities. Law enforcement oftentimes lacks materials in alternative formats, lacks staff proficient in sign language or accessing a sign language interpreter, and lacks staff who understand people who have a different ways of communicating. In my experience, and I've done quite a bit of work on training of law enforcement, both in Illinois and the state of Minnesota. In my experience, law enforcement officers are uncomfortable in responding to calls to group homes or other settings in which groups of people with disabilities reside or congregate. The perception is that Adult Protective Services or some other governmental body is responsible for investigating complaints of abuse or other types of victimization. Failure to take a criminal complaint and make a formal report serves as a vehicle for gatekeeping by keeping crimes committed against people with disabilities from entering the criminal justice system. In my work with law enforcement officers, I was repeatedly told that these cases were a lot of work and a waste of time because they were not seen as priorities for the state or county prosecutors. In my work in Illinois, I worked with Cook County and DuPage County State Attorney's Office, and they each had separate units specifically charged pursuing criminal cases of victimization against vulnerable adults. I had the good fortune to collaborate with the heads of these divisions on disability awareness curriculum for law enforcement officers and projects designed to address some of the deficits. So there are models out there, and there is good work being done out there. Another area of concern is the lack of affordable legal services as a barrier to victims with disabilities. Narrow definitions of abuse, assault by the criminal justice system fail to recognize the unique forms of abuse people with disabilities experience. For example, abuse by control and restraint, such as withholding access to medication and controlling assistive devices, is very harmful to people with disabilities, but often appears less harmful to the non-disabled population than actions involving direct assault. Barriers have been noted in the courts. In cases of domestic violence, court-ordered mediation forces victims to confront their abusers and risk the possibility that the abuser will twist the facts to make her or him appear to be the harasser or abuser. And there are many cases of particularly women, losing custody of their children because of the abuser has the upper hand, the power, and the resources within the court system. In order to address some of the barriers in the court system for people with disabilities, the Office of the Illinois Attorney General created training for judges as part of the Opening the Bench and Bow Project for People with Disabilities. Again, there are models out there in which we can better educate both prosecuting attorneys and the judges. There are also limitations in the ability for adult protection services to protect and serve vulnerable people with disabilities. APS are overwhelmed due to limited funding and large caseloads and tend to focus on elders as their priority. There is poor coordination between agencies providing protective services and those providing disability services. The focus of APS is protecting vulnerable adults and providing services when funding is available. While important, these efforts do very little to stop and prevent perpetrators from reoffending. It is important to recognize the role and limitations of the adult protective system. This system should not be used as a good enough substitute for the criminal justice system in cases of crimes committed against people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Attitudinal issues are a major area of deficit in the system. The ramification of disbelief in reports are made, stemming from negative attitudes and false beliefs about people with disabilities. So the consequences is that we have a poorly coordinated, ill-equipped, and unresponsive disability service, victim service, social service, and criminal justice system, and these consequences are grave for victims with disabilities. I provided some headlines from across the country. One of those is from Minnesota. What I'd like to say to the committee is that in Minnesota, we should not believe that somehow we are above or immune to this national tragedy, and I do believe it is a national tragedy. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine and I received a grant from the Office of Violence Against Women, a federal grant, to develop training for law enforcement officers in the state of Minnesota, and I do have a copy for you. It's an online course called Shadow Victims, Crimes Against People with Disabilities, and the training provides officers with an understanding of the issue, victimization, understanding of the laws, and understanding of ways to effectively communicate, interact with people with a number of different types of disabilities. One of the challenges is to get law enforcement officers to actually take the training. There is no requirement, and despite the fact that the training is quite affordable, it's not seen as a priority. When we were developing materials, we looked at the number of law enforcement entities, we looked at the disability community in South Central Minnesota, and we offered the training to the law enforcement department for free in my own community, and I was told by the director of public safety that their officers knew how to interact effectively with people with disabilities and that they didn't need the training, and that the officers that really came in contact with people with disabilities were the Adult Protective Service, assigned to Adult Protective Service cases, and they already knew this information. And I was shocked and appalled, and I'm sure that that's not an atypical response from police chiefs and administrators in the law enforcement community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fitzsimmons. I'm sure we have questions. No, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Dasha, for being here and for giving us inside scoop. do you know in your studies or your investigation if men and women who go through the law enforcement course get any type of training in working with disabled or that community whatsoever?
Right. In terms of in Minnesota, every state does law enforcement training differently. In the state of Minnesota, people can go into law enforcement, go to one of the two-year programs, one of the four-year programs, or one of the technical colleges to get their AA degree or their four-year degree. And then they require them to do their academy, their sort of skills-based training. There is no requirement specifically in the police service training that there's content specifically around people with disabilities. There's content that looks at working with people, human relations, but the content is going to vary from program to program. I know that administrators certainly in Cato, and it was my colleague that in that law enforcement department, that she covers that in a course that looks at vulnerable populations. There's no requirement, so there's going to be great variability. We did send out information on more than one occasion to all of the police service institutions in Minnesota to make them aware of this course and the availability for their students. I do know that all students now at Minnesota State and Ontario do get the training, and I know that Alexandria Technical College, Community College, is using that in one of their courses. There's no requirement. And there's no specific requirement for post-service hours. There is a requirement that they need to have so many hours every year on domestic violence, and so the training that they get may or may not look at people with disabilities as victims of domestic abuse. There's no specific requirements And it's not a high priority. And certainly after 9/11, what my workplace and what I found was that it became even less of a priority in terms of businesses.
Dr. Fitzsimmons, do you know, you mentioned that the disabled community is the highest minority in the nation?
Well, it's the largest, if you look at total numbers.
Okay.
And there's only 5 people using the definition that the federal government uses for the Americans with Disabilities Act. It is identified as having some type of disability. So that amounts to about 51 million people. It's about 1 in 5 people.
Madam Chair, and Dr., then do police officers or law enforcement or corrections know how many people have the capability of driving a vehicle or being in just everyday life because you get domestic abuse in situations or group homes? Do they have any idea from law enforcement or from the public safety standpoint of how many people they might be dealing with on a day-to-day basis throughout their, I mean, is there any type of training to give them some, and you said public relations in your courses that you have, but do they, as handling the public good, do they have any idea of who they might be dealing with on a day-to-day basis except they get a phone call saying, we got problems?
Well, my experience is that there's not much proactive being done. And if you look at Mr. Ball's case and others, that what seems to happen in law enforcement is it's after the fact. It's once a law enforcement department has been filed with either a criminal complaint or a civil suit that protocols, procedures, training, that these things get put in place, that there isn't enough proactively being done in order to learn more about the community. So the work that I've done in terms of reaching out to law enforcement is to encourage them to focus on sort of the community policing model, get to know the people in your community, get to know the service providers in your community, get to know your constituents, and to use them as a resource for addressing the needs of people with disabilities in your community. I mean, that's the model and that's the approach that in the training that I've done and the work that I've done. But this is not a priority throughout the country, and certainly in Minnesota. So I think that it's either unless somebody has a personal experience and they see this as a priority, or unless there is some complaint or suit, that seems to be when action is taken. It's not necessarily done proactively.
I had Dial was disabled and from those cerebral palsy. She's in a group home, and there have been times when the sheriff's department have been called out. It was just routine checking. Is one of the individuals that were living there called the police because they thought they were being unfairly handled by the workers and system. But I'm wondering how many times in situations where through your report it talks about the police officer saying, oh, that's for social services, or that's a group home, we don't handle that, and do they let, again, it sounds like they don't get any training in this as well. Is there a possibility to integrate with, because they both work for government, especially the county sheriff works with the county social worker, any type of way of, or have you seen it in your working in Illinois, of an integration of the law enforcement integrating, or getting an understanding of what the disabled community is about through the social section of the county government?
Well, I do know that when there are reports made, when a report is made of a vulnerable adult through Adult Protection Services, if the call goes into the county and they believe that it's possible that this is a criminal violation, that they will contact local and work collaboratively with local law enforcement. Law enforcement does the criminal investigation, Adult Protection Services looks at protecting the immediate needs of the individual and looking at what kinds of services can be brought in. I don't know that there's any in Minnesota that there is any specific data that would talk about how this typically plays out. What I know is what I've been told by both Adult Protection Service workers about and law enforcement, which is what I think one of the problems is that the adult protection services is a good system in terms of focusing on trying to look at protection issues and look at service issues for individuals, for families. But what I think too often happens, and again this is anecdotal, too often happens is that that's the easier route to take and not pursuing criminal complaints. So that we look at it as a social service issue and we don't look at it as a criminal issue. So that there are, I think, many instances that's the direction it goes in. And to me that's one of the failures of our system for people with disabilities. It's sure, let's use the adult protective services system, but let's not negate that if a crime has been committed against a person with a disability who falls under the category of a vulnerable adult may live in a group, why does that negate their right to have justice pursued in the criminal justice system? And there certainly are studies out there that look at nationwide where it seems to be that we are deferring to adult protective services and we are not deferring these cases through the criminal justice system. And as I talked about, that stories that have been shared to me by law enforcement officers, for those who have a desire to want to pursue, that prosecuting attorneys may be less inclined to take these cases to go forward and file charges, because there's a perception that people with disabilities don't make credible witnesses, that there's more work involved. And so there's some barriers on the prosecuting attorney side as well, and then there are certain barriers for judges, again, who not understanding the ability of people with disabilities to testify and give credible testimony. In some of the training that I had done from law enforcement and criminal justice professionals, one of the stories that was relayed to me, which is that when somebody commits murder, and the victim is now dead, we pursue an investigation and we pursue a prosecution and such, and we don't have a victim to give a victim statement. So that why is it then when it is a person with a disability, and particularly somebody who has difficulty communicating, that we aren't able to pursue the investigation, collect the evidence, and put forward a case, just like we do when we have a victim who is not able to tell their story.
Good point.
Very good point. Thank you so much, Dr. Simmons. Do you have a question? I think we do, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, thank you. I'm not sure I have just an easy question, but more of a lot of thoughts going through my head right now. One of them really ties to what Representative Vanderson was just talking about, which appears to be a blurring of the lines between APS and the criminal justice system. And it seems to me maybe we need to get back to APS as being a preventive rather than a law enforcement area. It seems like adult protective services should be proactive and be preventive, and if an incident has occurred, then we move that into law enforcement. And it just sounds like a blurring of the lines has occurred, either because people are saying don't bring this forward, it doesn't rise to the level of whatever. And I was particularly disturbed by your comment about seniors are a priority. Now, I have nothing against seniors, and I think seniors should be a priority, but I don't understand why we would prioritize them over a person with a disability. A person is a person, and it kind of took me aback that we would prioritize someone because they're older as more, I don't know, important than someone with a disability. And
well, if you look in the literature, and there's extensive amounts of resources, materials that focus on elder abuse. And when you look at disability abuse, there's more happening recently. There's federal initiatives that have been going on. So there is more happening, but it is within the adult protective system, there's far less focus or emphasis. And I do want to comment that adult protective services plays a very important role. I don't know that they have time to do prevention, frankly. So, because there's resource issues. But certainly that's an important piece. But they are the first line of intervention. I mean, if you have individuals who are living in dangerous situations. It's not the role of the criminal justice system to find them someplace else to live or to access the kinds of supports and services and resources. That's the role of social services, and that's what they should be doing. The problem is when law enforcement says, well, social services is taking care of this. We don't need to get involved. It's a social service problem. That's the problem that I don't want to, we don't want to get rid of the good things that adult protective services
does. Absolutely not. And I appreciate that. And the other piece, Senator, was you were likening a murder, to treatment when there is no one that can testify. And I would say perhaps law enforcement should approach this more like some states have taken with domestic violence, where it doesn't take a client to press charges or even testify against their spouse. It's identified as with a murder without testimony from the individual, but it's pursued because of the circumstances.
Well, if the person has a disability and it is a domestic violence, it falls under the incident falls under the domestic abuse laws. It doesn't matter whether the person has a disability or not. The officer is supposed to follow the law and proceed with making that arrest because there's probable cause. So whether or not they do that is a question. But when I made a statement about being really thoughtful about whatever policies are enacted, about doing something that will take away the rights of people, people within the disability community are often being very concerned, and rightfully so, about having somebody else decide that something must happen. And the stories that have been shared with me is that sometimes the brother that you know is better than the brother that you don't know. And if the person who is the abuser is your primary caregiver, or is the person that you rely on for economic support, or oftentimes for women with disabilities or children, if there is a risk that the abuser would get tested against children, people are reluctant, even though they know that in the long run it may be in their best interest. So I think we need to be really thoughtful about taking the decision making away from the victim in some of these cases. I mean, I make a choice whether or not to call an report. So be really thoughtful about that you don't do something that results in people being even more vulnerable, having no place to live, or having to move to some other kind of alternative that takes away their freedom or their independence or their choice making.
Sure. Thank you for that. And I there probably is a very fine line between leaving someone in a dangerous situation and removing them from it.
And that's where we're looking at the issue of who constitutes a vulnerable adult and the ability of that person to know and understand their circumstances and protect versus somebody who does not really understand the ramifications of making those kinds of decisions. So there is a very fine line.
Madam Chair, one last thought. You referenced, the speaker, Dr. Fitzsimmons, referenced an online training, and perhaps if we move forward, legislatures often accused of unfunded mandates, and there may be a cost to what, Representative Bingham is going to bring forward in her committee. But if there are some online options that are, you referenced the one, and I noticed you have many references at the end of the article, so there may be others.
Well, this is the training. And I believe it.
Perhaps there are some options that are less expensive that wouldn't be terribly outlandish, or we could look at a funding amount as we move forward with your legislation. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. I think we've had some more compelling testimony today. This has been a very interesting day for us to learn about some of the issues. I appreciate you very much coming in, and I think we will be calling you back again.
Can I make one more comment? I wanted to just say one thing about when we were talking about vehicle identifiers. One of the things that I think really these decisions are made to be very thoughtful about is that you don't want to put identifiers on that say, potential victim of this. So people are very thoughtful about identifying themselves. So that if there's some kind of sticker or license, those are choices that people make, but be very thoughtful that we can create make it more, we can create a offenders, people who seek out vulnerable individuals. We can make their job a lot easier by putting some kind of identifiers that everybody can see, so be really thoughtful about are we creating victims or how the circumstances are such that we create the likelihood that people would be targeted for victimization.
Thank you. We will definitely do that. Thank you so very much for coming in today. To the remaining testifiers, we have about 15 minutes left, so if you can just be aware of that in your testimony, that would be terrific. So the next person that we have here, we're going to call Larry Lovers. Apparently there's a time constraint for him, so if you can keep your testimony to about 5 minutes, that would be wonderful.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Larry Lovers.
And if you could both identify yourself, please.
My name is Larry Lovers, and I live in West St. Paul. Why I come here, I was in an institution, and I got a trait in me, and people didn't have no respect, and so I do a lot of talk for Disability for Act, and I go around town, and why I do it? Because it comes from my heart. Kids were making fun of me when I work at the Lego in West St. Paul. I started at 7 o'clock and kids would come up to me and make fun of the way I was walking, the way I was talking, and they would criticize the way I was doing stuff. And I did some talking to other schools in different places. I stick up for myself for everybody else. I went to see the school principal and the teachers and all that. And it was, sometimes it's scary in my shoes, but I like doing it. It comes from the heart. Because I was built it. I lived in them institutions. I lived in Fairbowl, where they just put a number on the grades. No name, just the number. And every time I look at that, it brings fear inside of me. Like I did something. And I can remember Mumona. I'm gonna pretend it's raining. It was out in the summertime with snow clothes on. And I got treated. I didn't get to go to school all the way. Only the special ed. Because the people didn't respect me. And I still can go downtown. And I got people that still make fun the way I walk, the way I do stuff. And last week at Rainbow, there were some Jehovah's Witness people, and I went to get Larry Adams, and they were starting to bother me because I believe in my God. I don't believe in everybody else's God. They come up to me and started to bother me, so I just ignore them after that.
And
thank you, Larry.
Thank you. And I'm Rick Cardenas with Advocating Change Together, and we are civil rights, human rights organization for persons with developmental disabilities. And Larry has been going around doing many talks to different schools, to different organizations, and he initiated that all himself because of the treatment he was receiving as he walked down the street. Now, much of the testimony was from up there at the policy level and at the, again, at the police level, but down here at the grassroots level, the leadership development that is in existence right now for persons with developmental disability is to define those things that have happened to them that may or may not be against the law. And once again, it's the prosecution or the persecution of them, but the failure of any prosecution of any of the perpetrators. Although Larry's experience has many of those times that it's happened to him, there were no prosecutions within that. There were no arrests, there were nothing. So the preventive aspect of what we're trying to do is to bring that to schools, to bring that to organizations and help other folks get an understanding of from the perspective of the person with a developmental disability or other disabilities also, that they should also be respected. So, good. Thank you so much for the chance to speak.
Thank you very much, Rick. Excuse me. Other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gardner?
Cardenas.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Mr. Cardenas, as Larry goes around and talks, and maybe he can talk to himself, the response that you get from teachers in schools and from the students themselves, is there a favorable feedback regarding the situation that he talks about, when in fact that he was made fun of, that he was laughed at, that his style of the way he walked and talked, is there a positive reflection back from students?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, Larry does speak to those schools, and Larry has walked past the same place where he was taunted and made fun of. But I'll let you tell him what happens now.
Well, now, Mr. Chair, and now they have respect for me. But before they didn't have no respect. They just put me down. And now they are my friends. But before, they were not my friends.
Madam Chair? Rick, regarding is this in St. Paul, or are others like this happening all over the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, actually this is part of a statewide project that we do. With the graciousness of this legislature last year, we've created an organization called Self Advocates Minnesota. And this is one of the specific pieces of that, is to help people to understand that they may or may not be a victim of some hate crime or some taunting, and that they have the civil rights to speak out and against that, and at the leadership development workshop that we put on, we have many people who for the first time have spoken of the abuses that they've received over their life and where they've come from, be it staff of particular institutions or staff of group homes or from the police also.
Any other questions? Thank you very, very much, Mr. Lovers, for coming in. Very nice to hear your testimony. Thank you very much, Rick. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Okay, next we have Roberta Blumster. Roberta, yes, you're still here, good. Roberta, you'll be speaking on the topic of abuse, correct? All right. You can identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify before you today. Hello, my name is Roberta Mae Blomster, and on the agenda was mentioned about me being a representative of the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, but I'm here today as a self-advocate and not as a representative of the council. One public safety issue that I know of all too well is, of course, abuse. In fact, when I was called, all the hurtful names, stripes, labels that people with disabilities to this day still get called, even the R word, that was not only ignorance and discrimination, but also verbal abuse. Boy, those people do not know how to treat us with respect. But I do know that it can get much worse than that if who wears a different version of the same thing. My niece, who is developmentally delayed and has Asperger's syndrome, was sexually abused by both of her parents. This really did hit me very hard when I heard about it, especially since I'm her aunt. To make the matter worse, she was removed from her home in 2005 because of the abuse by her father and placed into our home under family foster care. Before her mother had established a safe home for her, the county social worker returned my niece
fewer mother in the shelter. That was even against her therapist's advice and the family's advice. My family kept telling the workers that they need to investigate her mother as well. The workers seemed too busy to investigate. My niece was in foster care for only less than 2 months. Then less than 2 years later, she was abused by her mother. The system really failed my niece. We need to really train our county protection workers better or give them less of a caseload so that they can do thorough investigations before more harm is done to our children and adults with disabilities. As a special Olympics coach, we do have a very critical program that is part of our training and that is protective behaviors, and I am required to report any abuse that the athletes who I coach for track and field have endured. However, since I'm an athlete coach, I came up with a plan that if I see anything wrong with an athlete, that I would go up to one of the other coaches, including the head coach, and mention the situation and have that coach take it from there. The Arts of Minnesota Community Living Public Policy Committee has a lot of key issues, and one of them is promoting abuse prevention. That is something that should be considered when you help to write a bill on the topic from today's hearing. People with disabilities should need to feel not only protected but also safe, and with the issue that I mentioned, preventing abuse is even more important now than it has ever been. I am willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Representative Carlin?
Madam Chair. Roberta, I am so proud of you. I know you live in my area, and I've heard so much about you over the years, and I applaud you for what you're doing and continue to do. And I just wanted to bring that forward.
Thank you.
And also one thing to mention is that I was honored on September the 5th as one of the 2007 Revenue Care winners.
Any other questions? I've known Roberta for a number of years, and I really appreciate you coming in today and talking to us about this. And we're going to be addressing this in our committees. I think that several members here have been writing notes, so I think we're going to see some active legislation and a lot of policy discussion this upcoming year, and we'd like to be able to call you back to testify. And I'm very sorry about what happened in your family. That's a terrible situation for all of you to be in. Roberta, do you have anything else that you wanted to say, or?
I do have copies of my testimony here for everybody on the committee. It's a little different than what I just said. I have to make a few adjustments.
I know we have to shorten your time, but thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Roberta. With that, everybody, I appreciate you staying to the end. We certainly have heard a lot of compelling testimony today to discuss the need for us to look at our public safety regulation and funding our some of these systems. And quite honestly, I'm a little shocked at some of the information I received today, so I need a little bit more time to digest it before I can give a wrap-up here. But I just want to very much thank the committee members that came here today. Our next meeting is going to be on October the 24th, 9 a.m. in this room, and we will be having a discussion on housing, and in particular, what housing needs are for people with disabilities. Where are we lacking some supportive housing? Is there an issue of placement? Is there an issue of cost? Is there an issue of safety? You know, where are we putting people? So I'd like the advocates to be prepared to discuss that. On November the 28th, we'll be discussing poverty. And for those of us that have lived under the constraints of federal and state subsidized programs, we understand exactly what that means and how it compromises families. And I would like to have a very lively discussion on that on November the 28th. And perhaps it would be a good advice for everybody to watch Scrooge before they come to that committee hearing the next day. And then we are looking at February 2008. We do not have a date yet because we will be going back into session on February 12th. Jen will keep everybody up to date on that, but we will be discussing transportation. And in specifically, what transportation do we have to look at for people with disabilities to not only move them to and from medical appointments and things of that nature, but also to be moving them to work. The idea is here that we've got people at work, and how do we get them back and forth? And then we will be looking at finalizing a report to give to these various committees that we all have representatives on, discussing what we learned in this committee, and then going forward in their own representative committees to address these issues. So you've got friends on this panel. I hope you take advantage and make acquaintances with all of them. Many of you have made my acquaintance. I think it's time that we open it up. And again, I'm very grateful for everybody taking their time today. And the meeting is adjourned.